So welcome back to the last session of the day. So my name is Doreen Vacaras. I'm also a participant of the program that is going on here right now. And it will be my pleasure to share this session. So the first talk of the session will be given by Tom Lecomte from Argonne National Laboratory. So Tom is an experimentalist. He is the physics coordinator of the ATLAS experiment. So this morning we heard from the former spokesperson of CMS, so now we have a representative of the ATLAS experiment. So physics coordinator is really the, I would say the most important job.
I wouldn't.
So he has to make sure that the 3,000 or so scientists who have all their own ideas what kind of physics should be done at the LHC do the right kind of physics to really maximize the opportunity for discovery. And he will tell us about searching for physics beyond the standard model.
Thank you, Doreen. I'd also... And I'm done. I'd like to thank Lance and KITP and Lars in particular for inviting me. So I'm going to talk about physics beyond the standard model, but before we get started, I talk too fast, so please stop me. I would much rather this be interactive than just me yammering on, because the goal is not to cover as much material as I can, but to uncover some of it. So, who is this person? I'm the one on the left. I'm an experimenter. I've worked on a lot of aspects of particle physics, QCD, heavy flavor, SUSY, and Higgs. And I've realized I've spent a quarter century working on various beams of experiments that collide beams together. CDF at the Tevatron, STAR at RIC, which is a nuclear physics experiment, ATLAS at the LHC. As Doreen said, I'm the ex-physics coordinator of ATLAS. And basically, my shtick has been to take an experiment that's designed to measure one thing and to use it to measure something else. And sometimes many other things. So this is going to be the talk plan. There's definitely going to be some overlap with what you've heard before. Think of it as a second coat of paint. It's okay. And I'm going to try and tell my story through examples. Interleaved with the examples will be some descriptions of the instruments that we've used. You've seen some of this from Joe, and you'll get a different perspective here. And I don't think it's going to take all 50 minutes, and I think that's all right, too. I do like the sound of my own voice, but I think if it's interactive, this will be more useful to you, that's what I want. If Joe were here, I would apologize, but since it's being taped, I probably should still apologize. Many of the figures that I'm showing have been taken from my experiment, and the reason is pure laziness on my part. I could easily find those, and finding them from the other experiment takes time. So there's really a spectrum of opportunities the way that we do this. On one hand, you have a very well-defined specific prediction that comes from theory. If you look here, you'll see that. And an example would be the Higgs boson, which Joe talked about, or earlier, the top quark. In fact, Joe and I were on the same experiment that discovered this. On the other side, you've got what we call lamppost physics. You know, the story of the guy is looking for his car key under the lamppost, even though he lost it half a block away because the light is better here. There are things that we measure just because we have an instrument that's out there. And then in between, you have things that are more like supersymmetry or extra dimensions. You've got a family of predictions, but we don't know exactly which one it's going to be. So let me talk a little bit about lamppost physics. So as I said, the light is better here. And this is a search that's done more by motivated by what the experiment can do rather than some specific prediction. And the example I gave here is Galileo did not say, I am going to invent the telescope so I can discover the moons of Jupiter. It didn't work that way. But once you have these things, you can point them at the sky in various places and say, ah, I see this, I see this, I see this. And in general, every time we've had the ability to see something new, we've made a discovery. So the first question I want to cover is, why three? Right, and you've seen this version of the periodic table with these nice three generations of matter, and everything we know about is on this table somewhere. Now, a good theory is predictive, and we discovered two quarks and one lepton from this table. Interestingly, it might not be the ones that you've thought. This one and that one were the quarks, not in one column. And there's no good theoretical reason for these to line up in these columns. Now, in 2002, we learned that there are exactly three columns. Not three that we can see, you know, with some that might be too heavy to produce or off at the Planck scale or the gut scale, exactly three. And in my view, that was the most amazing discovery of the LHC. I mean, I understand the number zero, I understand the number one, but once you get beyond one, it's just many. So why three is quite mysterious. So to try and understand why we have this new periodic table, let's go back to an old periodic table. So we have Dalton's atomic theory. This was the first real particle theory of matter. And he said all matter is composed of tiny atoms. They're indivisible and indestructible, much like the meatballs in your cafeteria at your schools. All atoms of a given element are identical. Turns out he got that wrong, but it's close. Explains the law of definite proportions, which was kind of this mysterious empirical thing at the time. And this was a major scientific accomplishment, and understanding exactly where and why this fails leads us to something about how we might design an experiment today. So one of Mr. Dalton's problems is this: why should different elements show similar chemical properties? Why, for example, the sodium and potassium react the same way? Well, we know today it's because of the electrons. Chemistry is driven by the electronic structure of matter. And it's the fact that atoms have substructure, that you've got these electrons that are providing the chemistry, that they're not indivisible, and that gives us the organization of the periodic table. And in principle, you could look at the periodic table and discern something about atomic structure. In practice, it's easier to kind of go the other way. But this was the first hint that there are substructures. We have the same thing that we discovered in the 60s in particle physics. There was a second periodic table. If you take the 9 lightest spin zero particles or the 8 lightest spin a half particles, they also seem to line up into these nice patterns. And it looks like another periodic table is showing up. So pretty soon, people got the idea of, let's look for particles where there's a gap in one of these patterns. And they started to show up. So as I said, a good theory is predictive. So this is telling us something about substructure of the so-called elementary particles. Well, as people got more and more particles, we were able to make more and more patterns. And it's getting hard to imagine how all of these would be produced accidentally if you just get more and more and more. And the patterns turn out not to be random. They represent the same underlying symmetry of all of these. So in this case, this is something called SU4. And these are all different representations of it. So the modern view is the patterns that we saw in the last slides are all due because hadrons, particles like the proton, are being formed out of the same kind of particles, quarks. And many, many different experiments have done, all using different beams, different targets, whatever, and they all get consistent answers. There are two particles inside of a proton with charge 2/3, one of charge minus 1/3. The neutron has the pattern flipped. These are all held, glued together by a field of particles, which we call either very imaginatively or very unimaginatively gluons. Now, we can pull an electron off an atom. In 1869, cathode rays were discovered. So they were able to say, I know an atom is not indivisible because I can divide it. I can pull off something. And in fact, cathode rays are identical, irrespective of the material you use to make them. So it's saying that the different kinds of atoms are fundamentally made out of the same kind of stuff, just in a different arrangement. So there's another layer down, as represented by the Russian dolls. What we can't do is pull a quark out of a proton. So this is an important difference between atoms and quarks. So one of the analogies I have is a magnet. If I try to pull off a north pole of a magnet and put it in my pocket, I'm unable to do that. Right? The magnet that I get still has a north pole and a south pole, and the magnet I leave behind has a north pole and a south pole. So the same thing happens here. I take a particle like a proton, and I somehow grab one of these quarks and start pulling it and pulling it and pulling it. It starts stretching and stretching and stretching, and ultimately the string between the quark that I have and the particle that I'm trying to pull it out of breaks, and it produces one or more particles. So all the energy that I'm putting in to try and yanking this quark out of the proton goes into making new particles. When this happens, we get a jet, a blast of particles all moving in roughly the same direction. So you can see all of the particles that are produced here. This is the this is a beam's eye view of the detector. These are the tracks that are produced. Joe mentioned they're measured in the magnetic field. This is what we call a calorimeter. It measures the energy. If you unroll the calorimeter, you can see there's two blasts of particles. And if you look at a view where the beam goes this way, you see this jet and this jet, which are that jet and that jet. So Joe showed you a little bit about how Atlas looks. I'll skip most of the discussion. Those are fake people. I like this plot better than his because the two that you have here, that's a safety violation. and people get mad at me when I show that. But we have a small tracker inside of a magnetic field. We have this calorimeter, which is about the size of a house, which stops the particles and produces and measures their energy. Then outside of this, we have a muon spectrometer. Muons are particles which are highly penetrating, so you look at them on the outside. About one of them is going through your head every second from cosmic rays. That's what the inner detector looks like in real life. So you see it's about the size of a Fiat 500. The beam goes through there. That's the sort of output that you get. And it measures where the particle is point by point by point by point by point. And we end up with several dozen points, and then we just play connect the dots to make the track. As Joe said, this is a digital camera. It's 80,000 pixels, so it's maybe 5 cell phones. And you'd say, well, why is that impressive? It's because your cell phone probably can't take 100,000 pictures in a second. The calorimeters are the size of a small house. That's that, and these again are real people. It measures the energies of particles by stopping them. In this case, gives you sort of an idea of how big the individual units are. I can't because I cropped off the person, but this is about 6 feet. There's a guy working on the bottom right here. And this particular thing works by taking particles, interacting them with steel, and sandwiching this plastic, which glows when particles put on them, and measuring how much light comes out. And then on the outside, we have this muon spectrometer. And this will be used in measurements later in the talk. But essentially, it's a tracker on the outside rather than the inside after we've filtered everything except a muon. And this is the most important component. There's about 3,000 people working on each experiment, including 800 to 1,000 students, kind of depending on when they get their PhDs, in 176 institutions in 38 countries. And Joe mentioned a little bit about countries that don't particularly like each other. One of the things that we have people from Taiwan and mainland China, they agree that there's one China, but they disagree about which one it is. So we had to have a lot of discussions about exactly how to properly reference them. This is a picture of the compact muon solenoid, a schematic, and you can see the people here are somewhat larger, but it's the same basic idea. You've got tracking, you've got calorimetry, this is all done inside a magnetic field and muons on the outside. And in a few minutes, I'll talk to you in a little more detail about that. So this is a question that was brought up earlier. Why do you have two experiments? I would say there's a couple of reasons for that. One is each experiment is complementing and checking the other. So you know, you just have better science if you have somebody looking over your shoulder. You can imagine a problem with one detector generating a fake signal, one kind of detector. So by using different technologies, we protect ourselves against that. It's hard to imagine two different detectors using two different technologies making the same mistake. Certainly true if a signal is seen by two groups that might not particularly like each other, is more convincing than a signal seen by just one. If we have friendly competition, it helps generate new ideas. And as Joe said in the Q&A, you know, we do look at what each other does, and if the other experiment does something which we think is going to help us, of course we do that. So I would say that the way to describe Atlas and CMS is we're in a three-legged race. You know, we're either both going to succeed or neither of us is going to succeed. It doesn't do any good to have one experiment that's really wiping up the floor with the other. We want the LHC to succeed. So this is the same jet I showed you before. This is another one. I love jets. So while you know astronomers look at stars, you can look at them all day, I can look at event displays of jets all day. So there's another one. Here's an event with many, many jets. So here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and maybe you can see sort of a ninth as a shoulder over there. And here's a jet with here's an event with only two. So you've got one here and one there. So I can look at jets some more? Absolutely.
For example, but one of the previous speakers would, I think, reference that when you see a track coming out one direction and no track coming out the other, that was indicative of something?
Yes. So hold that thought, because I will get there, I hope. This means I'm giving the talk right, but not fast enough.
balanced.
Well, yeah, they're supposed to be balanced, and you can see this one looks pretty balanced, right? This one, heaven knows if it's balanced, right? Right, you need a computer to tell you that this one is balanced. So I didn't want to leave you the impression that only Atlas looked at jets. These are pictures of jets from the CMS experiment. They're not as pretty as the ones from Atlas, of course. And these are very common. About 1% of all events have jets in them. And so why do I like them? Why are they interesting? Well, the utility is what looks to be about the most inelastic process you can imagine, right? Two particles come in and a blast of new particles come out. Right, is actually the elastic scattering of two of the constituents. Right? And this was essentially discovered because of work that was done by David Gross, and this connection between the jets and the partons was studied by many people, including Dave Soper. But basically what happens is, at the microscopic level, I kick out, say, this blue quark and this red quark, and it turns into this blue jet and this red jet. So think about, you know, you're hitting a golf ball and all sorts of sand and grass and stuff kind of follows it. This is the same as you break a magnet and little magnet remnants are behind. So if you measure the energy of this guy, it tells you the energy of that guy. Likewise, if you measure the energy and the momentum of this guy, it tells you the energy and momentum of that guy. So it's the best window we have on what the quarks themselves are doing. And even though it looks very complicated when I say this jet had, you know, 30 particles, 25 pions, a proton or two, you know, it now becomes very simple because what you're really talking about is the quark that produced the jet. So when you look at something like this, what you're really seeing is quark scattering. So the two quarks came in here, well, carried by their protons, and one of them scattered up, and one of them scattered down.
Sorry, can I stop you again? Why only two quarks?
This is
two protons together. Why not six?
Well.
Oh, because
right.
The other four aren't close enough.
Right, so sometimes you do get lots of collisions, but also most of the time what happens is things go down the beam pipe. So I scatter, maybe this is the better viewpoint. So this guy here and that guy there just go down the pipe. We don't instrument that because it's on all the time. There's two problems, right? One is the beam has to get in, so we need a hole. But even if we didn't have that, there'd be no point in instrumenting that because it would be glowing all the time as the beam remnants keep coming through. So, you know, there's no point in measuring something where you know the answer. Of course there's a particle there. Okay, so let's go back to John Dalton and his mistakes. This picture is completely impossible under his view. All right, why is this impossible? Because, well, why do the fireworks have colors? It's because you put chemicals in them that cause them to their spectra to excite. Different elements have different spectra. The atoms show different energy levels because they have different configurations. And if atoms are indivisible and without structure, how can they possibly have configurations? How can you configure something that there's nothing to configure? Furthermore, the heavy elements show more complex spectra. It's probably hard to see hydrogen here, but there's four visible lines, whereas if you go to, you know, something like calcium or sodium, you see lines all over the place. So there's a hint that somehow heavy elements are made out of more parts than light elements. And today we know that these parts, these things moving around, are electrons. So let me draw a parallel between atoms and quarks. So if I put a lot of energy into an atom, it transitions to an excited state. It then emits a photon and returns back to its ground state, and we see a line spectrum like this. If I go to quarks, suppose I put a lot of energy into a quark, the quark would transition to an excited state. Now this only happens if there's a state for it to be excited to, but it's a hypothesis. And then this excited quark, this Q star, will emit a gluon, which will form a jet, and return to its ground state. So what would we see? Well, if you look at a jet-jet mass plot, you would see a bump where you had the excited energy level. So you're looking essentially at a spectrum here. One of these jets is the emitted gluon. The other one is the recoil quark. In atomic physics, the atom recoil is very small, but because of the energetics here, the recoil is large, so you get two things back to back. So the experimental question is whether this distribution is smooth or whether it has bumps on top of it. Now this plot was taken from our very earliest data. It was 111 days after we turned on, but most of those days were spent tuning the machine. There's probably maybe 30 or 40 days worth of data in this plot. So almost immediately after we turned on, we could see the inside of the proton more clearly than we could before. This is the kinematic limit of the Fermilab Tevatron. So all of these points out here were things that we had never been able to see before. And we looked for a bump. As you see, we didn't see one. So this is comparison of ATLAS and CMS data, and you can see the same thing. They're both smooth as a baby's behind. There's no bumps, there's no energy levels, there's nothing. So, as I said, we collected enough data for an expected limit beyond the previous best limit. We thought that was a good time to publish when we thought that, you know, our sensitivity had just moved past what it had done before. On Monday, July 19th, that was 111 days after the first collisions. On the following Friday, July 23rd, we showed the first results beyond what had been done before at, as Joe said, the ICHEP conference. This was 2 years before the Higgs discovery, but it was still the most important conference of the year. And we submitted the paper on the 13th. And as of today, the LHC experiments have published more than 1,000 papers together. So there's two lessons here. One is high energy is a huge advantage. Right after we turned on, we were able to say we see things that took the Tevatron years to do, and that large collaborations are not necessarily slow. Since I have a little time, I'll tell you another story about this. We had the result approved right before it was shown, and by right before, I mean, you know, we closed the data set 6 a.m. on Monday, and the talk needed to be in at 12:30 on Friday for a 2 o'clock presentation, and at 12:24 on Friday, we approved the results. So you know what that means. We could have taken 6 more minutes of data. So let me move a little bit on to the discovery of the nucleus. This is the so-called Rutherford experiment. This was done by his graduate students, Geiger and Marsden. But it's okay because of, you know, the credit worked out because the Geiger counter was invented by his graduate student, a guy named Mueller. So everybody gets the right amount of credit. It's just kind of one generation behind. So the way this works is, you know, you've got this alpha particle, hits the gold foil, and I love this animation, and particles come zooming on out. Alpha particles were the most energetic probe used at the time, so this was, in some sense, the first high-energy physics experiment. And the idea was, in the old Thomson-Plum pudding model, the electric field that this alpha experiences gets weaker and weaker and weaker as it gets inside the atom, because more and more charge is on the outside. But the alpha particle is, in the Rutherford model, the field gets stronger and stronger as you get close to this charged nucleus. Now, when you teach this, they say, well, the plum pudding model didn't really agree with the data, blah, blah, blah. But they hardly ever explain how badly it disagreed with the data. So the plum pudding model is blue, and what Rutherford actually saw is red. So at 3 degrees, there's about a factor of a million discrepancy between the old model prediction and what's actually observed. And I really wish more textbooks would point out exactly how crappy the result was compared to the model. I mean, it's very rare that a theoretical model is excluded to this level of accuracy on a single experiment. So it's also, you'll learn from this, is that since I'm talking about 12 orders of magnitude here, that's not a particularly convenient thing to be looking at. So the experiments transform these variables to ones that are flat or almost flat if there's no substructure. So, but essentially we do the same thing. We look at the angles between two jets, and from that we try and say, is there an excess of large angle scatters? Same experiment done by Rutherford. So this is what we mean by flat. It's flat-ish. But if there's a signal, this bin, the first bin in this plot, will jump up. All right, and that's just an excess of large angle scatter. So these are small angles, these are large angles, and the data are consistent with being flat. You can sort of see the error bars get large up there, but we would have been able to exclude something that was here or here or here. So from this, we can extract a limit. There's no substructure down to a length scale of 17 zeptometers. And Joe introduced you to zeptometers. I think we both heard zeptometers from the same person, Pierre Savard at Toronto. It's a great unit. I have no context of zeptometers. You know, I just have no feel, so let me try and put it in perspective. If an atom were the size of the Earth, a nucleus would be about the size of the Washington Monument, somewhat rounder, but basically this size. From past experiments, we knew that quarks had to be smaller than about a blueberry. Immediately after we turned on the LHC, this 111-day paper, we knew that quarks were smaller than a pea. So that's sort of what you get immediately after you turn on. We've been running for a couple of years, and today we know that quarks are smaller than a single sprinkle on a Pop-Tart. Can anyone guess the flavor? That's correct. These are strawberries. Because you have multicolored sprinkles, whereas cherry has only red sprinkles. Raspberry, no sprinkles.
Is that all relative to the Earth?
Yes. Yes. So let me put in a mid-talk summary. We have some indirect hints that quarks might have substructure because we've got these columns. If you try to isolate a quark, instead you get a jet of particles, but that's okay because the jet is the next best thing to the quark. We look for substructure by looking for spectral lines, like in this plot. We don't see any evidence. We also look at the angular distribution a la Rutherford, and we don't see any evidence in this channel either. So let me bring up a second question. Are there any unknown forces out there? So you heard from Brian and Laura about the strong force, the weak force, the electromagnetic force, and we pretty much gave gravity short shrift. Interactions, I like that term better than forces, are carried by particles. So this particular interaction turns a quark-antiquark pair into an electron-positron pair, and in the experiments we plot the mass of the electron-positron pair, and lo and behold, we see a peak, again like a spectral line. This peak is at the mass of the Z, and the fact that this mass is 90 and not zero is what got François Engler and Peter Higgs the Nobel Prize. It's the Higgs mechanism that moves this from zero. So, could there be another heavier Z? Sure, we would call it a Z prime because we need to call it something. And there are pros and cons. One of the pros is you can always add a Z prime to the theory without breaking the theory. Now, it might not agree with data, but the theory itself maintains its mathematical consistency. On the cons, it doesn't solve any problem that we have. It doesn't solve dark matter, it doesn't solve the unification problem, it doesn't explain why atoms are neutral, it would just be there. But if nature produced a particle that was just there, we'd still want to know. Now, I'm an experimenter, so my job is to look and see what nature is like, and I don't particularly care if the theorists tell me that it should be there or shouldn't be there. We just go out and look, and the way we look is we look at electron pairs and we look at muon pairs, and we plot their masses and we look to see if we can find a peak. So this is the basic idea. You've seen something very similar from Joe. You've got this tracking chamber, then you've got a calorimeter, in this case two calorimeters, and then muons. So tracking, calorimetry, muons. And this is driven by the way particles interact with matter. So electrons come in, they're charged, they leave a track, they deposit energy in the hadronic electromagnetic calorimeter and no energy in the hadronic calorimeter. Muons go straight through, so you see them on the outside because these are very penetrating. Now, because the physics is the same, the experiments look the same. So CMS is tracking calorimetry muons, Atlas is tracking calorimetry muons, even though we use different technologies at all three pieces, because that's driven not by what we designed, it's driven by the way particles behave. So this is how we identify electrons. An electron comes in, hits a piece of material, produces an electron-positron pair, which hits material and produces a photon, which produces an electron-positron pair. You can see it all described there. This is a picture of what it looks like if you do an actual simulation of it, and gives you sort of the idea of how many particles you're really producing. So if I have a W particle, basically I produce something on the order of 90,000 electrons. So we're counting the electrons. The plates here in this accordion are made out of lead, and in between we have liquid argon. The argon is ionized by the 90,000 electrons that we create, and we measure that ionization. The reason it's an accordion is because we would like the gap to be very, very small so that the detector works quickly. You'd like to make the measurements and then to clear it out of the detector in time for the next collision. It actually doesn't work. So to get enough charge, we have to drift them for several collision crossings. So Joe talked about pileup when you have 20 collisions there. These detectors actually see more than just those 20 collisions. They also see collisions that happened before. So we decided our job wasn't hard enough. So that's a picture of kind of how it's built. You see it's in many different segments. And the reason for that is we'd like to track the electron shower. The electron is coming this way. We would like to track it by saying, okay, this much energy went in the front, this much energy in the wavefront, this much energy in the middle, and that much energy out the back. We'd like to measure it as it goes through because that helps us reject background. This is what it looks like now. It would look like now. It's sitting inside a cryostat so nobody can see it, but that's kind of what one segment looks like. CMS uses a completely different technology. So they use crystals. Particle comes in the crystal. You have the same interaction where you generate thousands of particles from one. And each one of those little tiny particles you produce interacts with the crystal and produces a little bit of light. So you collect that light and measure it. So ATLAS says, we'll start with the energy. We'll produce ionization and turn that into an electrical signal. CMS says, we'll take the energy, convert it to light, and then turn that light into an electrical signal. So this is, as we've said before, different technologies lends robustness to anything that we see. You can imagine one or the other of these having some pathology that we don't know, but to have both of them have the same pathology and a different technology is hard to imagine. That's a picture of the CMS calorimeter. The muon detectors, as I said, muons are highly penetrating. I mean, since I've been talking, 1,000 of them have gone through your head. Basically, what we say is you stick up enough material and anything that goes through it is a muon. CMS has one magnet, and the field is coming out of the board and looping around and going back in. So the muons go through, they're bent by the field, and then they're bent the other way by the return field. So you get two measurements for every muon, one on the inside and one on the outside. This is, as Joe said, this is the biggest and most powerful superconducting magnet in the world. ATLAS took a different approach. Instead of one giant Mongo magnet, we took four merely enormous magnets, and we bend in the different directions. So at this side, we bend in the plane that you're looking at, that is in the beam's eye view, and then in this direction, we bend in this view, we bend in the opposite direction. So this, we again have two measurements. To give you an idea of the stored energy in this, the energy in the magnetic field is 1.2 gigajoules. The energy stored in a lightning bolt is 1.5 gigajoules. We are very careful when we turn these things on and off so that this is controlled. Compromise is a fact of light. Experiments would like not to be constrained by resources, but we are. Every dollar that goes into one subsystem is a dollar that doesn't go into some other subsystem. And you can replace dollar with Swiss franc or Japanese yen or whatever you need. You've got the same problem. If I use my resources to build detector X, I'm starving detector Y. But that's not the only resource. Space is a resource. Every inch I use, or centimeter, to build this detector is taking it from something else. And we used all of the space that we have. The clearance between the ATLAS detector and the ceiling is 20 millimeters. So this is an issue. Turns out there's a bigger issue. When you take all that rock out of the cavern, the floor starts moving up at about a millimeter a year. So ATLAS has a finite lifetime, determined by when it's finally crushed by the ceiling. Fortunately, it's slowing down. A collaboration with N members, whatever N is, can't build an experiment that needs twice as many to operate it. So you might want to build something more complicated, but you just can't. And industrial production capacity is finite. Crystals, wafers, whatever. The SSE experiment, SDC, there was a guy who said, we should build a liquid xenon calorimeter. And George Trilling, who was the spokesman, said, that's a fine idea. Why are you telling us now? Because it's 20 years before we'd ever built this. And he said, well, if we need to fill this with liquid xenon, we have to start liquefying it now. So you need to build something. And as Joe said, most experimenters have their own ideas for the best way to optimize because we have different expertise and interests. And the goal of a collaboration is to build an experiment that everybody can tolerate, even if it maybe isn't everyone's first choice. So anyway, getting back to the Z prime, here's an event with two energetic electrons. This is a beam's eye view. This is an electron, and you wonder why I can't see the other one. Well, in the calorimeter, you see it over there. And the reason you don't see it is it's going very far forward. So that's what the data looks like when you look at all of the events. And there's a couple of features you should see. One is the regular Z is there at 90, like it should be. There are no other peaks. The red peak here is what a Z prime would look like. And you look at this and you say, well, you know, this says that I should be seeing, you know, 24 or 36 events, and I see exactly zero. So I obviously didn't discover this. These four colors represent four different backgrounds. And backgrounds are events that look exactly like what you're searching for, but they come from a different and usually boring source. So the name of the game often is revolving around understanding what your background is. Finding the signal is the easy part of analysis. The hard part is saying, I saw more signal than I expected. It's calculating the expectation that's hard. So I said we didn't discover anything, but that doesn't mean we didn't learn anything. So these are plots that you'll see a lot of. We often call them Brazil plots because of the green and yellow. This axis is how often per collision you produce the particle. Above this line, we would have seen a signal. So if nature was over here, we would have seen it, but we didn't. Below this line, we wouldn't. And you see various models that are coming here. So in this model, for example, it crosses our line at about 3 TeV. So we say, if there was a particle lighter than 3, we would have seen it. We didn't, so it doesn't exist. So, my second mid-talk summary. These searches require us to reconstruct and identify various charged particles, electrons, muons, jets. You've seen them all so far. The two experiments make different choices in how they do this, but that's a good thing. It adds robustness to the measurements. And there's some art to this. It's done by people. There is no perfect answer. These also require us to be able to determine the backgrounds. And sometimes you need to calculate it, and sometimes you can get it from the data. So my third and last question, why does the Higgs boson weigh what it does? Brian talked a little bit about this. So the problem is it weighs 125 GeV. It's about the same as an atom of barium. This is too light to be heavy and too heavy to be light. So by too light to be heavy, left to themselves, quantum mechanical correction should make the Higgs boson a quadrillion times heavier. So it would weigh 20 micrograms. One Higgs boson would be macroscopic, well, sort of macroscopic. Unless there's a symmetry, like supersymmetry in these corrections. So if every particle has a partner with opposite sign, that drives this down. It turns out this has two problems. The first one is it tends to work too well. It tends to drive the Higgs mass below 90, and that's what I mean by too heavy to be light. So you have to fuss with the theory a little bit, so the cancellation is not quite perfect. And these are the logarithmic terms Brian was talking about. But the bigger problem is where are these other particles? And I'm an experimenter. I can help with that part. I can't do anything with the theory. Another nice feature is that most variations of supersymmetry predict a stable, non-interacting particle. And as Brian and Joe said, this might be the dark matter that makes up 80% of the matter in the universe. Not matter plus energy, just matter is about 80%. And if you could make some in the laboratory, wouldn't that be neat? Because you could compare the properties of the thing you made in the laboratory with the properties of the thing that you predict. The way we do this is missing ET. So we know momentum is conserved, right? Everybody here believes momentum is conserved. So in this case, we have a W decaying to an electron and a neutrino. Here's the electron. And unfortunately, we put the neutrino in purple. We've already done the problem for you. But essentially, nothing is on the other side here. So you've got an electron recoiling against nothing. So you have two choices. You can either believe that momentum is not conserved, or you can believe something undetected went out the back end. And in this case, we think it's a neutrino. Now, so you calculate the momentum of everything you see, reverse the sign, and that's the thing that you didn't. Now, we only work in the transverse plane because many particles go down the beam pipe where you can't measure them. So how might these events look? So you've got visible objects in one hemisphere, maybe in this case two jets and one muon. So you've got lots of activity in this hemisphere and nothing on the other side. So you calculate the missing ET and you say, I've got missing ET in this direction. And in this case, perhaps it's because you had two particles, neutralinos, invisible to the detector that went flying through. So we infer the presence of undetected particles by the momentum imbalance, this missing ET, missing transverse energy. Now, I drew two. There's no way you could tell how many you actually had. Could be one, could be 10, because you didn't see them. So all we're really sure of is that something went out the back end. And many, many, many different models exist with different predictions of what you see on the visible side. So this is an example of that middle class of models where you've got, you have a family of models rather than one single prediction. And we see these events. Shouldn't you be flashing me 5 minutes? Okay. So the good news is we see these events. Unfortunately, this isn't perfectly horizontal, but if you draw the line right around here, you see the jet over there and nothing on the other side over here. The bad news is while we see these events, we don't see any more than we expect. And that's the problem. So it's, you know, we can look at the backgrounds, but we haven't seen any particular excess. And the key to the analysis is not about finding the signal events, right? A trained monkey could find the signal events because the computer writes out any event that has more than a certain amount of missing ET. The real trick is to say, I've got more of these events, or I don't have more of these events in the background. So calculating the backgrounds is tricky and getting trickier. In the Z prime search, this was easy. There were four backgrounds and only one of them made any real difference. In these searches for Suzy, there could be 7, 8, 10 different backgrounds and maybe four of them could be important. So calculating them to the accuracy that we would like is straining the capacity of the worldwide computing grid that Joe talked about. So this, by the way, this is the commercial. This is the thing I do, so you're stuck with listening to it. What I do is I work on using supercomputers to calculate these backgrounds. So this is Mira, which is located at my laboratory. It's the fifth fastest computer in the world. It has 768,432 CPUs. And there have been times where we have used all of them to be calculating various backgrounds. And we've used 165 million CPU hours to calculate backgrounds for supersymmetric signals. So that should give you an idea of just how hard this is. These are the results, and we put these on plots that nobody can actually see, so nobody really knows if this is right or wrong. Each of these groups are various different models, and we don't see anything, and these are the limits that we've all set. So we've looked at dozens of models. So far, we haven't seen any hint of new physics, but we continue to look and look and look and look and look. And finally, a bit of fun. This is a plot you might have heard people talk about. It's got a little tiny excess at 750 GeV. And this is ATLAS data for two photon events. And as I said, a new particle manifests itself as a bump. And okay, are we seeing something? Well, one question you can ask is, what's the probability that chance alone gives you a fluctuation that's this high? And the answer is one in a few thousand. And we can argue whether it's 3,000 or 5,000, but that's the scale. How many papers have we published? Well, about 1,000. And half of them are measurements, but the searches often have multiple channels. So it's, again, it's of a similar order. All right, so you can then ask, well, does the other experiment see the same thing? And I think the best answer is, well, sort of. In certain ways it agrees, and in certain ways it doesn't. You can say, what about the earlier data? And again, it sort of agrees. In some ways it looks the same, and in others it doesn't. What does theory say? Theory with a capital T. I would say it can accommodate a particle here, but it didn't predict one. Once this excess was shown, there were 280 theory papers that hit the web saying, we knew this all along. A prime number. but it didn't predict one, and it certainly doesn't solve any problems, right? This doesn't produce dark matter or anything. My personal view is I don't find the case for a new particle as it stands particularly convincing, but I'd sure like to see what happens when we get 10 times as much data, because that will definitely settle things. You know, we don't have to argue whether 1,000 and 3,000 are the same number or different or whatever. So, to sum up, I hope I was able to convince you of a few things. One is that there are many, many possible things that we could look for, and I showed you three. I think the technology that does this is impressive. It impressed the heck out of me. I would not have thought we could build a microscope with zeptometer-level resolution, but we did. Every search has features that are in common and features that are unique to it. And having two experiments that make different choices, I think, strengthens the overall program. And while we haven't found anything behind a single Higgs boson, I find this kind of amusing. You know, oh, Nobel Prize winning physics, great. What have you done for us lately? But nonetheless, there are many things that could be visible at the LHC, and we're looking, and maybe even by the end of this year we'll have something. So I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Tom, for this very nice talk. So there's, of course, time for questions. Any questions for Tom? Yes.
I thought you were my friend.
I have two related questions. You said that there were hints that there might be substructure below the quark level. And the related question is, are there any such hints that there's substructure inside the lepton?
Yes. So the fact these things have patterns, like a periodic table, I think is a hint. Right. I just don't understand what that hint is telling us. You'd like to sort of imagine that you've got something, prions are the words that is used, things that are in one configuration give you quarks and another configuration gives us leptons. But there's no actual evidence that that's what's causing this. So the other interesting thing is atoms are neutral. To a very high degree of accuracy, we know that atoms are neutral because we don't throw lightning bolts off when we walk. Right? And the reason that happens is the quarks and the leptons have the same charge within small integer ratios, 2/3, 1/3, not 0.68 or 0.64, because that would cause us to explode and throw off lightning bolts. Why? If they're completely different kinds of particles, there's no reason for these charges to fall into these nice ratios. If, on the other hand, there's some sort of substructure that they're made out of the same kind of thing in some way, then it makes perfect sense. So that's a hint, but I wouldn't call it evidence. You know, you still need Columbo to say just one more thing.
Yes.
A lot of different particles can be detected, not every kind of particle, but what fraction of the kinds of particles you can detect are actually detected? Do you detect all the electrons and only half the muons that come out? Or?
So there's detection and there's identification, right? So if an electron hits a live region in the detector, I mean, we have cracks and things that are not working. So, but the 90-some percent of the detector that's live will detect that. But whether we're actually able to identify it as an electron depends on a number of things. And in particular, it depends on how many fake electrons you're willing to tolerate. So if I want to say, oh, and these numbers are just ballpark. If I say, I'm willing to detect, you know, I want to detect 95% of those electrons, probably 1 in 20 or 1 in 30 of those electrons will be fakes. There'll be other particles that we've called electrons. But if I say, I only want to identify 80% of my electrons, then only 1 in 1,000 of them are fake. So one of the things that choices the experimenters make is when I'm doing my analysis, where do I adjust my knobs for identifying particles so that I have the most acceptance for signal relative to the background? And of course, if I make the cuts loose, I get more signal and more background. I make them tight, I have less signal and less background, but they move differently. So part of the art of being an experimenter is to figure out exactly how you want to do this. Furthermore, you have other choices you can make. So let's say I have an electron and a muon and missing the energy that I'm looking at. I have three different knobs to turn. I might not say I want the best electron as I can because I might be willing to take a better muon or more missing ET. So there's this complicated multiple variable space that people optimize either by using very clever computing or lots of experience and say, this is how the whole analysis goes together. Does that answer your question? Does it answer a better question?
My question's pretty basic. So when you get to 10 to the 16 GeV, what scale are you measuring at?
So this is a scale of something like 10 to the 12th. Right, so that would mean whatever is one level down from Zepto.
A Groucho meter.
It would be a Groucho meter.
Okay.
Or would that be a Grouchometer?
It'd be a Harpo meter.
But I like the when, by the way. I like the when.
Hi, I have one here. You were comparing the atom to the quarks and the protons for a couple examples, and I had a question. You said that an electron can be jumping up to an excited state and falling down, and you were comparing that to a quark doing the same thing. Can you explain again how that quark can be excited?
So if a quark is made out of these prions, whatever they are, right? They're sitting around doing whatever it is that they do, and I put enough energy into them, and let's say they're orbiting, it would then go to a wider orbit and then go down. Just like in an atom, I've got an electron in the ground state, photon comes in, and it can jump to a higher orbit. But this only works if the particles are made out of pieces. So this is kind of a one-sided test. You can never prove that they're not made out of pieces. You can only get evidence that they are.
Any other questions?
In your talk, you contrasted several times experimental versus theoretical physics, and I was curious when your path diverged at your PhD studies or in work, and also what is the intersection with your work with theoretical physicists?
So I'm an experimenter. I decided fairly early in my career that if I was going to be a physicist, I would be an experimenter. Basically, as an undergraduate, when I wasn't even sure I was going to graduate school. And there are a couple of reasons for this. One is I was better in the lab than I was in class. So that's a sign. You should do something that you're good at. I understood things in the class better when I had done the measurements myself. Again, another good sign for that. You have to be a really exceptional theorist to make a contribution. Right? Every theorist in this room is really exceptional. Going out and measuring stuff, you know, the number is the number. Right? So, you know, the career path is different. That said, I have written 3 theory papers with colleagues, mostly on the intersection between how we measure things and things that might be models that might be interesting. So to get that interplay right, you want somebody who understands the models and how to calculate them and when they make sense, but you also want someone who can tell you what the experiment can do. In 2 of those cases, I worked with Steve Martin. I've worked with great names. Bill Murray, Steve Martin, Roger Moore. Steve Martin and I discovered that the experiment was sensitive to a particular class of models more than people thought, which was an interesting result, but also that with making slight changes to the way that we looked for things, we could be even more sensitive. So that was rolled back into the experimental measurements so that the next time we did this, we were all set up and ready to go, and we were able to do a better search than we would otherwise. So this interplay, I think, is very important. And this is one of the reasons why I'm here at KITP. I didn't come just to talk to you, that was a bonus. I'm here because it gives me an opportunity to work with theorists for 2 weeks to advance the field as a whole. And that's why I will again thank Lars for the kind invitation to get me here, because I think it helps the field, not experimenters, not theorists, not this experimenter, to have this kind of interaction going on so that the whole field can advance. And I think KITP plays a very, very important role in that. Don't you wish I was here when the NSF was here?
You had a slide where you said if you could grip onto a quark and pull it out, you would have another particle that would come along with it.
Yes.
Can you talk any more towards that? I have questions, but I have too many other little ones. Can you talk
we'll put
more?
That up.
Yeah.
It's not a great analogy, right? But it sort of tells you what's going on here. You know, let's go. You believe them? You're with me as far as the magnets go? Okay. So you can think of quarks. One of the things that quarks are little particles that move around and have dynamics. But they're also kind of boundary conditions on what's going on. So in a very real sense, trying to pluck a quark out is very much like pulling a pole out. So it takes energy to get this farther and farther away. Think it's on, like on a spring, and eventually I can stretch the spring to the point where it breaks, and now I have the North Pole in my hand, or the red cork in my hand, and on the other end of the string is an anti-red, anti-cork, or a South Pole, depending. Does that answer the question?
Just as a follow-up on what he was saying, when you were showing the jets, though, you were showing the jets as individual quarks.
No, they're individual particles, but none of them are quarks. So most of the jets are these guys, these things that are left over. Because one of the interesting things about quantum chromodynamics is when these strings break, boy, do they break. So you get lots and lots and lots of particles. So instead of getting, you know, take the magnet case, breaking the magnet into two, I get magnet dust at the end. And they all end up producing these particles. This is because it's a strong theory. This is why we call it the strong force. So you're able to produce a lot of particles from this energy.
Any other questions for Tom? Yes.
I know there's a lot of emphasis on studying quarks and particles at high energy, but what happens to gluons at very high energy? Do they play any role different than what they do at low energy?
Yes. And talk to the man next to you. He got a Nobel Prize for explaining exactly that. So 13 and 8 doesn't make a whole lot of difference to the physics. It makes a lot of difference to the rates. Because what's really happening is, we're not really looking at protons. We're looking at the quarks and gluons that are carried by the protons. So what ends up happening is, if I go to higher energy, I can look at quarks and gluons that carry less momentum, a less fractional momentum, than at a lower energy. And there are many more quarks and gluons at that lower fractional momentum. So the idea behind this is it cranks your rate up. So it actually does two things for you. The rate goes up because it's easier to bring to have high rates at high energies. It brings the rates up because you're going down to what we call low X. That is, you've got many, many more of these particles. And then the few that are right out on the tail that give you very, very energetic interactions, we get to see those collide as well. So it opens up a new field. So, you know, you can't be too rich or too good looking or have an accelerator that goes to too high an energy.
Okay, we have a few more minutes if there are some more questions for Tom before we continue.
Uh-oh.
What fraction of the events do you actually get to look at on display? In other words, you didn't talk about all the challenges of
Joe gave some of the numbers out. So every 25 billionths of a second, so 40 million times a second, we say an event, but it's actually something like 20 collisions. So the rate is 40 megahertz times 20, which is about a billion per second. Of those, we can write out perhaps 1,000. All right, but 1,000 per second times 10 to the 7 seconds is 10 billion. So a computer can filter through 10 billion events, but no human being can look at 10 billion events. I would imagine that probably about 10,000 have been hand scanned, the most interesting ones. The most interesting ones are usually not the ones that are at the edges of the search. These are events where something went wrong. Because the easiest way, for example, to get an event with a lot of missing ET is to have part of the detector off when you think it's on. And searching through, looking at pictures of events can tell you that, gee, this part of the detector was off. Nevertheless, it was marked as on. So these kinds of just mundane, prosaic things all have to be checked, because it would be kind of embarrassing, right, to say, we have a brand new particle, and the reason we have a brand new particle is somebody shut off part of the detector and didn't tell anybody.
So
hand scanned.
Over what period?
Per year. I mean, 10,000. The number is sufficiently fluffy that a year, 2 years, 10 years, it's all the same.
I have a question about the
You were supposed to be my friend, too.
I'm trying to be. Statistical physicists have made a lot of use of this notion of fractals. objects that are highly ramified in some cases, that is the branches have branches and those sub-branches have sub-sub-branches and so on. Do these ideas penetrate at all the study of jets?
There are people who are looking at this. One of the hot topics isn't so much fractals, but the idea of jet substructure. Because, you know, as events get more and more energetic, the pieces of the jet get closer and closer together. So if you want to count the number of quarks that come out, you can't count the number of jets anymore because you can have multiple ones in the same jets. There was just a week's worth of work being done right here on asking the question, are we squeezing every last bit of information out of the jets? And a parallel question is, you know, are we looking at everything we should be looking at? Because, you know, we talked about jets, but this is just relativity that puts particles together. So you might ask, you know, if I want to ask about photons, do I have to worry about my photon identification getting bad because it's so boosted that other things are starting to land on top of it? So this is going to be an issue as we move up in energy, as we move up in luminosity, and if we ever build one of these giant super accelerators, we're going to have to live with this in spades because everything's going to be screaming. But, you know, this too shall pass. We will get this straightened out.
So, Tom, you were so kind to compliment the theorist, but I think it takes a very special experimenter to pull experiments like this.
And you can invite him next time.
Yes. Thank you.